Good evening. I'm Aubna Nawaz. Judy Woodruff is away. On the News Hour tonight, facing questions. Top U.S. military leaders take heat from lawmakers and contradict President Biden on America's withdrawal from Afghanistan. Then, high stakes. Progressive Democrats in the House dig in, threatening to vote against the president's bipartisan infrastructure bill just days before the key vote. And the cost of COVID. School closures in Uganda lead children to help their families survive, with many being trafficked into forced labor.
2020 was the first year in two decades that saw an increase in child labor around the world. And with the pandemic devastating economies, the United Nations says the problem is getting much worse.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Strategic failure. That is the assessment of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Mark Milley, on the end of America's 20-year war in Afghanistan. Nevertheless, top commanders recommended to President Biden that the U.S. keep troops in Afghanistan. The president rejected that, and the Americans and NATO allies withdrew on August 31st. Milley, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, and General Frank McKenzie, who runs U.S. Central Command, all appeared before the Senate Armed Services Committee today. Nick Schifrin has that story.
Let me call the hearing to order.
In the Senate committee responsible for military oversight, the military's leaders said today that earlier this year, after 20 years of war in Afghanistan, they advised it was not time to withdraw. Central Command Chief General Frank McKenzie.
My view is that 2,500 was an appropriate number to remain, and that if we went below that number, in fact, we would probably witness a collapse of the Afghan government and the Afghan military.
That refutes President Biden's August statement to ABC News' George Stephanopoulos that the military supported the withdrawal.
They didn't argue against that.
So no one told, your military advisors did not tell you, no, we should just keep 2,500 troops. It's been a stable situation for the last several years. We can do that. We can continue to do that.
No one said that to me that I can recall.
Was that a false statement by the President of the United States? Remember, you do not have a duty to cover for the president when he's not telling the truth.
Republicans seized on the president's having rejected military advice. Alaska's Dan Sullivan.
On the biggest national security fiasco in a generation, there has been zero accountability.
Mississippi's Roger Wicker.
Our credibility has been gravely damaged, has it not, General Milley?
Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley.
I think that our credibility with allies and partners around the world and with adversaries is being intensely reviewed by them to see which way this is going to go. And I think that damage is one word that could be used, yes.
And after two decades of war, more than 2,000 Americans killed, 20,000 Americans wounded, and the Taliban in control in Kabul, for the first time, Milley admitted defeat.
An outcome that is a strategic failure. The enemy is in charge in Kabul. There's no way else to describe that. That outcome is the cumulative effect of 20 years, not 20 days.
The commanders defended the chaotic evacuation of more than 100,000 Afghans and Americans, and they said President Biden did take their advice on withdrawing by August 31st, even though thousands who wanted to leave were left behind.
If we stayed past the 31st, which militarily is feasible, but it would have required an additional commitment of significant amounts of forces, probably 18th Airborne Corps, 15, 20, maybe 25,000 troops, we would have had to re-seize Bagram. We'd have to clear Kabul, the 6,000 Taliban that were already in Kabul. That's what would have happened beginning on the 1st. And that would have resulted in significant casualties on the U.S. side, and it would have placed American citizens that are still there at greater risk.
But the war's critics say that argument for rapid military escalation was the heart of the U.S.'s strategic failure. And even Milley today agreed that despite years of training, the Afghan military wouldn't have survived U.S. withdrawal no matter the date.
Well, I think the end state probably would have been the same no matter when you did it.
Indeed, senators and commanders revisited a series of fatal mistakes, creating the Afghan army dependent on the U.S., Afghan corruption, and U.S. failure to create strong Afghan institutions. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin.
Did we have too many strategies? Did we put too much faith in our ability to build effective Afghan institutions, an army, an air force, a police force, and government ministries? We helped build a state, Mr. Chairman, but we could not forge a nation.
And wavering American commitment. Milley confirmed for the first time that President Trump tried to withdraw unconditionally late last year, months after the agreement signed in Doha with the Taliban that first promised U.S. withdrawal.
The Taliban were heartened by what they saw happen at Doha and what followed, and our eventual decision to get out by a certain date. I think the Afghans were very weakened by that morally and spiritually.
Separately, Milley defended his actions during the Trump-Biden transition, when he reassured his Chinese counterpart that the U.S. wasn't going to attack, and when he talked with Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi about nuclear procedures and ensured with Nuclear Command staff he was part of the nuclear reporting process.
At no time was I attempting to change or influence the process, usurp authority, or insert myself in the chain of command.
Moving forward, the military says the Taliban has not broken with al-Qaeda, which could reconstitute within 12 months. But the military doesn't know if it can effectively target terrorists in a country where there are no service members. Arizona Democrat Mark Kelly.
Are you confident that we can deny organizations like al-Qaeda and ISIS the ability to use Afghanistan as a launch pad for terrorist activity?
I would not say I'm confident that's going to be on the ground yet. We could get to that point, but I do not yet have that level of confidence.
That's because today, as it was 20 years ago, Kabul has no American troops and is ruled by the Taliban. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
In the day's other news, the Senate faced a stalemate over raising the federal debt ceiling and avoiding a national default. Republicans again blocked Democratic efforts to raise the debt limit as Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned that the deadline is October 18th. Yellen appeared at a Senate hearing and appealed for Congress to take action or risk economic chaos.
America would default for the first time in history. The full faith and credit of the United States would be impaired, and our country would likely face a financial crisis and economic recession as a result. It's necessary to avert a catastrophic event for our economy.
Meanwhile, Democratic factions worked on paring down a sweeping domestic spending bill that now totals $3.5 trillion. We'll return to the political battles over all of this after the news summary. On Wall Street, stocks had one of their worst days in months as inflation worries and rising bond yields took a toll. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 569 points, 1.6%, to close below 34,300. The Nasdaq fell 423 points, that's nearly 3%. And the S&P 500 gave up 90 points, or 2%. The nation's COVID-19 booster shot campaign is off to a fast start. White House officials say at least 400,000 people got them over the weekend and another 1 million scheduled appointments. But the CDC's director warned today that only 30% of pregnant women have been vaccinated at all, and the rate is lower still for minorities.
About 15% of African American women who are pregnant are vaccinated, and this puts them at severe risk of severe disease from COVID-19. In August this year, we lost 21 pregnant women to COVID-19. So we absolutely have the data that demonstrates the overwhelming benefit of vaccine and really very little safety concerns at all.
Separately, New York City's COVID vaccine mandate for teachers is back in effect for now. A federal appeals panel upheld it last night, but teachers said they'll appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll take a look at vaccine mandates for hospital and nursing home workers later in the program. The U.S. State Department now says two American siblings have returned from China after being blocked from leaving since 2018. Cynthia and Victor Liu arrived home on Saturday. China defended holding them until now as it pursued their parents in a money laundering case. Beijing also denies any link between the Liu's and Canada's release of a Huawei executive who'd been held on U.S. fraud charges. The U.S. has reportedly extradited a convicted hacker back to Russia. It's a rare move since the two countries don't have an extradition treaty. Russian media reports Alexei Burkov was detained today upon arriving in Moscow. He'd been serving a 9-year prison sentence in the U.S. for operating websites that enabled credit card fraud and hacking. Investigators for the World Health Organization say agency staffers committed sexual abuse during an Ebola outbreak in Congo. The findings were commissioned by the WHO. They cite at least 83 alleged incidents and implicate at least 21 WHO workers. In Geneva today, the agency's director in Africa addressed the victims, some of whom were as young as 13.
We in WHO are indeed humbled, horrified, and heartbroken by the findings of this inquiry. As WHO leadership, we apologize to these people, to the women and the girls, for the suffering that they have had because of the actions of our staff members and people that we have sent into their communities to help in a very difficult situation of an epidemic.
The Associated Press has reported that senior WHO officials were informed of the abuse claims back in 2019, but failed to act. An overloaded boat docked in Sicily overnight with nearly 700 migrants on board. That marks the biggest arrival in Italy in 5 years. Passengers were mostly from Africa and were crammed together on a rusty fishing boat out of Libya. After disembarking, they headed to a reception center. Nearly 45,000 migrants have reached Italy this year. That's nearly double the total at the same point last year. Back in this country, the Georgia man accused of killing 8 people at spas in the Atlanta area pleaded not guilty to 4 of the killings. Robert Aaron Long entered the plea in Fulton County, Georgia. He'd already admitted guilt to the other killings in a separate county. 6 of the 8 victims were women of Asian descent. The gunman who killed 5 employees at a newspaper in Maryland was sentenced today to life in prison without parole. Jared Warren Ramos opened fire with a shotgun at the Capitol Gazette in Annapolis back in 2018. It was one of the deadliest attacks on journalists in American history. And the Obama Presidential Center had its celebratory groundbreaking on Chicago's South Side today. The former first couple attended along with Chicago's mayor and the governor of Illinois. The center will house the Obama presidential papers, plus a museum and other facilities. The project had been delayed over concerns about displacing black residents and historic preservation. Still to come, on the NewsHour, vaccine requirements face widespread legal challenges amid a shortage of healthcare workers. COVID school closures in one African country lead to children being trafficked into forced labor. Farmers struggle to protect their livestock from the threats of climate change, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Well, it's a crucial day for negotiations on both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue today. As we reported earlier, Democrats are working around the clock to reach an agreement on 2 significant pieces of legislation central to President Biden's agenda. One is the bipartisan infrastructure bill, and the other is the president's $3.5 trillion spending package. Our Capitol Hill correspondent, Lisa Desjardins, is here with me now for more on what's at stake. Lisa, good to see you.
Good to see you.
It's a busy day on Capitol Hill. Yeah. Let's start with these 2 big bills. Just where are we right now?
Well, it's about as clear as a glass of mud, to be honest, at this point. And somehow it got even muddier today. Let me explain what's going on here. As we've reported, the infrastructure bill has long been connected to that larger, we call it reconciliation package. Mm-hmm. That's how they want to pass it in the Senate. And Speaker Nancy Pelosi had said she would take a vote on that infrastructure bill Thursday. Well, she has an all-out rebellion from progressives who think if that happens, it will jeopardize that reconciliation bill. So we saw this statement today from progressives. Pramila Jayapal, someone we've talked to here on the show, reiterated, doubled down on this statement, saying we will only vote for the infrastructure bill after passing the reconciliation bill. That then was bolstered by Senator Bernie Sanders, one of the top progressives in this country. He came out and said today, we thought we had a deal that the two would only go together. He told people not to vote for the infrastructure bill this Thursday. So how do they get the reconciliation bill moving? First, they need to figure out how big it's going to be. There's a real divide over that. And we're watching 2 key senators. Everyone is watching them. Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. They are moderates who have said that $3.5 trillion number for kind of gross spending in this is too large for them. But, Amna, they have not come up with their figure yet. Everyone is watching and waiting. The clock is ticking. And we'll see if this infrastructure vote happens Thursday or not.
We'll see. There's a lot of maneuvering. You're going to be following it all. We talk a lot about those politics and the procedures, though. Let's take a step back and talk about what's at stake. Democrats are fighting hard for what's in that reconciliation bill. Let's just dig in and talk about where they are and why they're still divided. Let's start with one of the biggest issues, climate. Where are they?
I'm so happy we're doing this, talking about the substance of what's in these things. So this is one of the biggest portions of this bill, especially for progressives. And I want to just run through really quickly what they want, what is in this bill. This is a kind of a very minimum look, but look at what's in here. First of all, the reconciliation bill would have extensive clean energy tax credits for individuals and businesses, but it also has some carrots and sticks. It would reward or penalize businesses based on how much renewable fuel they're using versus how much fossil fuel they're using. And then also, I have to say, there's issues with this, of course. Manchin is one of them. He's worried about coal jobs in the short term. There's also a real question about Senate rules and whether all of these mechanisms can pass the kind of narrow channel that reconciliation measures have to. You know, a reminder that obviously climate change is one of the biggest issues facing this country. That's why the stakes are so high right now, because Democrats realize this may be their only chance, perhaps this generation, to really get something significant through. And I talked to members leading this effort today, and they really are sweating this. They're worried about these provisions staying intact.
There's another issue that really resonates with American voters out there. That is drug costs. Where's the discussion on that?
This is a point of contention between Democrats amongst themselves about what they should do. First of all, let's talk about drug costs in this country. I don't think I need to tell many of our viewers. They're high. Mm-hmm. They're higher than the rest of the world. And in fact, you know, they're about 2.5 times higher than most of the rest of the world. America on its own represents almost half of all of the money coming into drug companies in this country, in the world. So we talked to one of the experts who's testified before Congress on this, Harvard Medical School's Aaron Kesselheim, about this issue.
There have been, of course, reports from patients with diabetes unable to afford their insulin and having to ration their insulin, or patients who are needing to get cancer treatment, not able to afford the cancer therapy that they need. And those kinds of things can have important impacts on their health.
That's why this is on the table. What would Democrats do in reconciliation? So far, what we've seen in the bill, a few things. First, they would like to expand Medicare to include vision and dental over a series of years. They would also have Medicare negotiate drug prices. That Medicare has such leverage in the industry, could completely change what people pay in drugs, and it would be based on what other countries pay. The issues here. Moderate Democrats are worried that Medicare would go too far, change the drug pricing for too many drugs, and that American drug companies would be harmed. They are in the minority, but they are enough to potentially hold up the bill. So we're going to watch that very closely.
So another thing we've heard them talk about is making historic investments in childcare, especially after this first pandemic year. What could the bill do? Where's the disagreement here?
Right. So a reminder on childcare, of course. You know, we have an affordability problem in this country when it comes to childcare. And a matter of fact, when you look at 41 industrialized nations around the world, America is almost at the bottom in terms of affordability for childcare. So on this, we also talked to an expert to get us a sense of where we're at. Brandy James Lawrence is with the Bank Street College Education Center.
In more than 40 states, I think 40 states plus the District of Columbia, the cost of childcare is upwards of a mortgage payment for an average family.
My apologies, that Brandy Jones Lawrence. Quickly, here's what they would do on this. Democrats' plan right now, they would cap childcare costs based on income. There would be a tax credit that they would continue the current tax credit, $3,600 up to per child. The question is, would they limit this based on income more than they're doing right now?
Very quickly, before we let you go, a couple of other looming deadlines, raising the debt ceiling, funding the government. Where do we stand on those?
Right. It does look like Democrats, I can report, will have a way to fund the government past Thursday. We should learn about that tomorrow. We're cutting it close. On the debt ceiling, there's two ways to do things in the modern Congress, the hard way or the excruciatingly hard way. This is excruciatingly hard. There is not a path yet on the debt ceiling. We're going to watch it day by day, week by week.
We'll be watching it.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
You're welcome.
And for more on the Democrats' plans now, I'm joined by the chairman of the House Budget Committee, that is Representative John Yarmuth of Kentucky. Mr. Chairman, welcome back to the NewsHour. Always good
Thanks.
To see you. Let's talk
Thanks.
About those two big economic bills, the infrastructure bill, the reconciliation bill. They had been moving through together. Speaker Pelosi decoupled them. You have some of your colleagues, progressive colleagues, calling that a betrayal. Do you agree with that?
No, it's not a betrayal. I mean, what we're trying to do is navigate a very, very precarious waterway right now, where we have no margin in either the House or Senate. We can lose three votes in the House, no votes in the Senate, and we have some differences of opinion about how we can get these two major initiatives done. The good news is two things. One is both the moderates and the progressives, I'm a progressive, both groups want to get both of them done. And the second thing is they're both overwhelmingly popular with the American people. And if I might add a third, these things are both things that we absolutely have to do to serve the country well, to serve the American people. So I'm convinced that ultimately we will get them done. We'll compromise. There's always compromise. I never doubt Nancy Pelosi's ability to, again, navigate these very precarious waters. But, you know, again, I think all those factors mean we'll get it. We'll get them done.
So Congressman, I guess the question is how? How do you navigate that tough path? In what order do they move through and how quickly?
Well, I think what's going to happen in the next 48 hours, and, you know, the good news is that nobody will remember that I said this, but I think that over the next 48 hours, there are going to be enough agreements reached on the specifics of what will go into the Build Back Better Act, which is the larger bill. That's the partisan bill. And that the moderates will, that the progressives will say, okay, we're confident enough that we can support the infrastructure bill. Remember, if one goes down, they both go down. I think that's kind of the eternal truth here that we're dealing with. And, you know, I feel good about the fact that really we're only talking about 8 to 10 Democrats who are really laying down the red lines. And I think we'll overcome that.
But you need many of those 8 to 10 Democrats. So I'm curious why, with the language we've been seeing, why you think those Democrats, those progressive Democrats, would be willing to basically take a leap of faith, right? You're saying that they would sign on to the infrastructure bill with enough assurances that what they want will be in that reconciliation bill. Is that what you see happening?
I think that, you know, this is a question of good faith right now. And there, I think there is a question of on both sides as to whether it's good faith. But I've heard conversations behind the scenes and, you know, on the staff level, and I don't think the positions are nearly as rigid as what we're seeing and hearing in the public arena.
So you're saying what we hear from Senator Sanders, for example, as my colleague Lisa just reported, telling House Democrats to vote against the infrastructure bill, that there's a different message being delivered behind closed doors?
Yes. And you know, for instance, Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Progressive Caucus, she's acted very responsibly throughout this message. And yes, she's advocating very strongly for her priorities and the priorities of the Progressive Caucus. But she's left enough of the door open to allow her to say, okay, we believe that we can get both of these done. We'll go ahead and not kill the bipartisan bill on Thursday if it comes up for a vote on Thursday, which the Speaker has said it would.
Just to follow up on that, you said if there, do you still think that vote will happen on Thursday?
The last word I got from the Speaker was yes.
Okay, we'll take that on this day at this time. I got to ask you about just two other major things that you have to deal with on your plate right now. That is government funding and raising the debt ceiling. Republicans, we should remind folks, have blocked that bill that would do both. And you've got some looming deadlines. So what's the plan?
We sure do. Well, we're going to pass probably tomorrow a continuing resolution. Republicans in the Senate have said they would support it. So I think we'll get that done before the deadline Thursday night. As for the debt ceiling, we have, according to Secretary Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, somewhere around the 18th of October. So we have some time. What I'm hoping will happen, we're going to pass on the next couple of days what we call a clean debt limit suspension, which means there's nothing else on it. And what this will be to put Senate Republicans in a very interesting spot, because there's no way they can hide their vote. They will be voting to default on the full faith and credit of the United States. I don't think that's where anybody in Congress wants to be. And, you know, my Senator Mitch McConnell, who has bizarrely said, we absolutely have to raise the debt limit, but I'm not going to help you do it, and neither are Republicans. To me, that's kind of like a mother saying, yeah, I know my baby needs to have food to eat, but I'm not going to feed her. I'm going to rely on the nasty woman across the street. And it's just an amazingly irresponsible position to take. But I think, ultimately, One option is, and I hope this is the case, that at least 10 Republican senators are sane enough to say, we're not going to let the nation default. We'll break ranks with Republican leadership and help the Democrats pass the suspension of the debt limit. If not, we will probably have to resort to a reconciliation motion, a resolution that will take some time. It generally takes at least 10 days, probably 2 weeks to get done. We'll do it on our own. The other option, which is the one that makes the most sense, is we put this bill up to suspend the debt limit, and then Republicans just don't filibuster it in the Senate. So they get their wish. Democrats will raise the debt limit or suspend the debt limit by themselves, no Republican help. Just don't filibuster. That's all that. There's actually a pretty easy solution here.
Well, let me ask you about that path ahead if you have to move without Republican support, because Mitch McConnell has said Republicans are unified in their opposition to raising the debt ceiling. It was just a week ago you said that you didn't have enough time for Democrats to be able to move ahead without Republican support to raise that debt ceiling limit. Janet Yellen saying October 18th. Do you have enough time?
It's close. Again, it's a 10 to 14 day process. And so if we started it Monday, which whatever that day is, the 3rd or 4th, that's I think the 4th, then that gives us, if we can get it done in 2 weeks, it's right up against the limit. It is really playing with fire. And we've already seen some of the havoc that could be created by this. We saw the Dow Jones average plunge 500 points today. The market's very volatile right now. Bond rates are changing. Because of the uncertainty, so we really need to do this. It would be unprecedented. We've never defaulted on our debt in 100 years since this debt ceiling was put into the law. We need to get rid of the law, actually.
There's a lot to follow on Capitol Hill. We know it's a busy day for you. We appreciate you making the time. That is Congressman John Yarmuth, Democrat from Kentucky, Chair of the House Budget Committee, joining us. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, New York State has become the first in the nation to require all healthcare workers to get a COVID-19 vaccine or face being fired. Before last night's midnight deadline, there was a dash for vaccinations. Of the 450,000 hospital, nursing home staff, and other healthcare workers, the governor's office said today more than 90% have gotten at least one shot. But as John Yang reports, many hospitals are bracing for staff shortages if they have to lay off workers or some leave the profession altogether.
Anna, while New York Governor Kathy Hochul says the vaccine requirement is needed to try to curb the spread of COVID, she acknowledges the problems it may create for hospitals already strained by a surge of cases caused by the Delta variant. She's declared a disaster emergency, opening the door for healthcare workers from out of state and even out of country to practice in New York.
It reflects my priority to stop this virus dead in its tracks. We are over it. We are done. We want to move on. And the only way we can do that is to ensure that everyone is vaccinated, but particularly individuals who are taking care of the people who are sick.
To see the effect on one healthcare operation in New York, we're joined by Tom Quattrochi. He's president and CEO of the Erie County Medical Center, which operates a hospital and a nursing home in Buffalo, New York. Mr. Quattrochi, thank you very much for joining us. What's been the compliance with your staff so far on this vaccine requirement?
Well, thank you, John, for having me. We're down to about 5% in the hospital of folks that had to go on unpaid leave as a result of the vaccine mandate. In our nursing home, it's a little different situation. About 20% of our workforce is on unpaid leave. And that's kind of a common theme among nursing homes because some of the workers are lower on the wage scale. They're able to make other choices and get out of healthcare if they choose to be unvaccinated. So for us, it's a challenge because obviously patients need to be discharged from the hospital to nursing homes. So it's kind of clogged up a lot of hospitals with patients who really belong in nursing homes but are stuck in hospitals.
And what are those numbers doing to your operations in terms of elective surgery and that sort of thing?
So about a week ago, we started seeing this effect that I discussed about nursing homes kind of not accepting our patients. So we had the highest census we ever had in history with 56 people waiting in the ER. So we took some mitigating steps We stopped inpatient elective surgeries. We stopped many of our outpatient visits. We stopped medical ICU transfers from rural hospitals and other lower levels of care. So we took some mitigating steps that did have an effect on lowering the volume. Right now, we have a lot of people that remain taking extra shifts for us, and we incentivize them to do that, and that's working very, very well. But, you know, this is a longer-term problem. In the short run, we're managing the situation, but we're very concerned long-term because we had some of these staffing issues prior to the decision to do a vaccine mandate.
And you say, at least in the hospital, a lot of the unvaccinated workers are so far being put on unpaid leave. You're not severing them altogether from employment. Are you hopeful that they'll come around, that they will eventually become vaccinated, or what's the situation?
Yeah, we weren't certain what the actions of the state would be around the date, so we wanted a little bit of flexibility with those workers. They do have 30 days before their employment will be terminated, and there's some question around exemptions and religious exemptions and those types of things. For us as a public institution, it's very hard to sever somebody from employment and then bring them back. So we have a unique challenge in that regard. That's why we decided to do the unpaid leave.
Are you talking to them at all?
We are. Well, you know, many people actually, as a result of the incentive to work extra shifts, which is obviously extra money, some of them came back and received vaccinations because of that. So, you know, you never know what's going to work in getting somebody motivated to be vaccinated. But, you know, as we continue to educate, and I hope colleagues continue to talk to them about the importance of vaccination, we'll get some folks back. But the reality is there are some people that just believe in either choice or they don't want to be vaccinated for whatever reason, and they're leaving healthcare.
And you said there's a difference between the hospital workers and the nursing home workers. The nursing home workers, you say, tend to be lower on the pay scale. Is that right? And so more likely to go elsewhere?
Yeah, the way the reimbursement models work for nursing homes is it really doesn't support as much nursing care as it maybe probably should. We actually have a higher nursing ratio than many other nursing homes, but it's supported by a lot of aides. And those aides are, you know, in the range of anywhere from about, you know, $18 to $20, somewhere around there. And as you know, many, many organizations are offering that kind of wage for workers, including fast food restaurants. So they can't get the benefits maybe that they would, you know, have at a place like ours, but they can get the same wage.
If the governor had not placed this mandate or placed this requirement on healthcare workers, had you been considering doing it on your own?
We hadn't. We had not considered that. We were, you know, continuing to educate our staff, and we were also worried about the fact if we did it, then those workers could go to another hospital somewhere else. So it was a competitive issue for us. So, the government's doing the right thing for all the right reasons. There's just a reaction and effect that it has on the healthcare industry. So we're trying to work with the state government, and we're supportive of the vaccine mandate, but we just need some help with the reality on the ground.
And as we said, the governor's opened the door to not only out of state, but out of country healthcare workers. Is that something you think you might avail yourself of?
We'll have to see if that can be helpful. We're just grateful that the governor's trying everything that she can do in her power to help us. It's a challenge. Agencies across the United States are charging crazy amounts of money for agency nurses, talking 150 to 200 hours an hour. Normally, it's about $65 an hour for an agency nurse. So the demand that's been created nationally for agency nurses is a real challenge for everybody in healthcare.
What as you look forward, you look ahead, what are your concerns?
I worry about burnout of our staff. They've been through a lot during COVID, and I think it was a shocker for them to think they're going to have even less people in the institution. So we worry about the long-term sustainability of these types of staffing levels and making sure that we can take care of many of the patients that come into our care.
Tom Quattrocci, the CEO of Erie County Medical Center in Buffalo, New York. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John.
Well, the effects of the pandemic on children vary dramatically depending on the country. With schools still shuttered in Uganda and other developing nations, many children have no choice but to work to survive. In Africa, more than a fifth of all children, or some 87 million kids, work. Special correspondent Fred Desam Lazaro reports from Kampala.
It looks like a scene set in the Middle Ages, a gaping, sprawling stone quarry just outside Uganda's capital. It is also a gravel factory, all of it done by hand, large, small, and very small hands. Evelyn is 11 years old. She works every day balancing on a makeshift ladder to crack open the rock face. Her family will then pound the larger rocks into gravel with crude hammers. For some, the only available tool is a larger rock. Evelyn's mother, Sylvia Noguja, who has done this work for more than a decade, labors by her side, next to six brothers and sisters. For all this work, they earn less than $2 a day. That's the whole family.
We go and break stones, like that plastic jerry can you see there. We fill it at 300 shillings for each jerry can.
It's exhausting, dangerous work. A scene repeated at dozens of sites in the area. Accidents and injuries are common, especially among young children.
Life is not okay. When I break these stones, sometimes they cut my fingers. Sometimes the small pebbles fall into my eyes. Life is not good. Another time, a big stone hit me on the head, right here.
But what weighs on Evelyn most is her life before the pandemic. Aside from a few weeks between Uganda's two COVID surges, schools have been shuttered across this nation of 44 million.
I miss school. I miss work at school. I work every day. I would like to be a doctor or a nurse. I wanted to go to school, go to university, possibly go abroad and help my mother.
It's not uncommon to see young children doing hard work, fetching water or wood for the family cook stove. But whether in quarries, mines or farmland, more and more children are being forced to work for their survival.
2020 was the first year in two decades that saw an increase in child labor around the world. And with the pandemic devastating economies, the United Nations says the problem is getting much worse. It issued a report that found 160 million children, some as young as five, working in child labor, many doing tasks that directly threaten their health and safety.
I saw a nine-year-old in a gold mine.
As the mother of a nine-year-old herself, human rights advocate Angela Nabwowe says the encounter stopped her in her tracks.
I was practically looking at my daughter doing that work. I talked to this girl. She lives with her grandmother. They have nothing. Nothing. A nine-year-old in a gold mine working. It is not right. It is not.
She says years of progress have been wiped out by the pandemic, as have the income and prospects of a large number of Uganda's poorest people who live hand-to-mouth in the mostly informal economy.
The urban areas, the official data, is that 23% of that lost everything. They do not have any source of what? Income, because of COVID-19.
It's not just income, she says. For many children, the loss of school has deprived them of a reliable meal each day. As we saw in this school in 2017, meals are often provided across the developing world to boost both nutrition and attendance. That all stopped when the schools closed.
Food is a basic right. People don't have what to eat. And what is the effect of that?
It's been pretty catastrophic.
Tyler Dunman, a lawyer with the human rights group, is on loan to Uganda's Director of Public Prosecutions. Unlike children such as Evelyn, who work with their parents, many have been trafficked into labor, he says. It's illegal, but enforcement is spotty, complicated further by the pandemic.
Oftentimes they're finding themselves on the streets begging or being forced to sell things, or as they call, hawking things here. Those situations have increased exponentially.
So has trafficking into the sex trade, he says. Young women are particularly vulnerable, and there's another risk. Social workers we talk to say they've seen a spike in teen pregnancies.
I'm 15 years old.
We visited Esther in this Kampala slum. She enjoyed school and got good grades, and when school stopped, she took a job in a food stand to help out the family. Then she became pregnant, the result of boredom and rebellion, she now admits. When the baby arrives in February, school will be out of the question. Impractical, she says, and unaffordable.
I was studying to become a doctor. I missed the company of my friends. We used to sit down there, we would talk, we would be reading books.
What is your dream for your future?
My dream is if I have a chance, I want to learn how to weave hair, do hair, and in the process, be able to start my own business.
How do they survive? Because the parents cannot meet their basic needs.
Rogers Mutawe runs the Uganda Youth Development Link, part of a team of charities that work with at-risk youth. Since March of 2020, the number of young people they're helping train for safer jobs has nearly doubled. When we visited, they were learning baking, cupcakes on this day.
And so we are trying our best as a program, as an organization, to be able to give them a second hope, to give them a future to their lives. Because in most cases, these young people are vulnerable, they've been left alone, they have low self-esteem, they have depression.
He took me to meet 14-year-old Christopher. 2 years ago, he dreamed of being a professional soccer player after completing school.
What was your favorite subject?
Math and science.
Now he works from 4 in the morning until national curfew at 7 p.m. at a food stand in Kampala's Banda slum. His mother, Harriet Namulondo, sells meat kebabs nearby. It is not enough, she says.
Are you able to buy enough food for the family today?
We do not eat after lunch. That's the end. We stopped eating dinner long ago.
For its part, the government hopes to open schools by the new year. By when it hopes, teachers and staff will be vaccinated. Health Minister Dr. Jane Ruth Acheng.
We are losing, you know, a generation of people who would later on become economically productive and steer this country ahead. We are doing our best to ensure that we open schools as quickly as possible, but also open schools not to close them again.
Opening schools is only step one in what many activists say is a long road to repairing a public education system that is desperately short of the resources children and their teachers need. Although tuition is free, various fees and expenses for uniforms put school out of reach for many low-income Ugandans. Evelyn's mom says she'll do her best to send her and her 6 siblings back when schools reopen.
I dream for my children to be okay, to be able to support themselves in the future, and also to be able to support me. I want my children to have a good life.
For now, I'm grateful for one thing, she said. None of my children has gotten ill or seriously injured. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSam-Lazaro, just outside Kampala, Uganda.
And Fred's reporting is in partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. Farmers across the country are struggling to keep their livestock cool enough amid high temperatures and dangerous heat caused by climate change. As Illinois Public Media's Dana Cronin reports, livestock producers are searching for ways to keep their animals safe.
It's feeding time on Borgic Farms in Raymond, Illinois. Hundreds of 12-week-old pigs are crammed into a long barn, climbing over each other in search of feed. It's pushing 90 degrees today, and the air here is humid and heavy with the smell of pig manure. Phil Borgic owns this farm. He just turned on 8 massive cooling fans with 6-foot blades to suck the hot air out of the barn.
If the temperature comes up like this afternoon, then where it gets warm enough, then we'll turn on those waters. But the first thing that comes is a breeze, and then it gets warmer yet, then we bring out the garden hose and hose down the kids and cool them off.
Borgic's parents bought the farm in the 1950s, when most livestock farming was done outside. As the climate warmed over the years, they've since moved things indoors to help keep the pigs safe from increasingly high temperatures.
As we went through time, our fans kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger to pull more air through and over the top of the pigs and to get that heat out of there. And then right at the beginning, we didn't add water. And so as we learned, we started adding that sprinkle water then to help cool them off some more.
Average temperatures in Illinois have already gone up by between 1 and 2 degrees Fahrenheit over the past 100 years. Right now, the state sees about a week of temperatures above 95 degrees during the summer. Climate scientist and University of Illinois professor Don Wibbles says if we continue emitting high levels of greenhouse gases, the state will only get hotter and the heat will last longer.
If you looked at the high scenario, which is what we're following right now, most of the summer ends up being above 95 degrees. Again, very different Illinois than we have right now.
Those scorching temperatures threaten not only farm animals' comfort and health, but also their productivity. Amanda Stone researches heat stress in dairy cows at Mississippi State University and says when the heat index is above 68 degrees Fahrenheit, much cooler than the 90 degrees here today, a cow's milk production can decrease up to 25%.
So if a cow is producing 100 pounds during periods of heat stress, she's only producing 75 pounds.
And it's not just cows, it's goats too. Every morning at 5 a.m., the 100-plus goats here at Prairie Fruits Farm and Creamery outside Champaign, Illinois, file in for milking. Milk meters measure how much each goat produces per day. When it's hot, farm co-owner Wes Jarrell says there's less milk, and he has noticed the changing climate is having an impact.
We've always known that in the summer heat, their production goes down. And we know just by looking at the records that the duration of that and the intensity of that is increasing.
Prairie Fruits Farm is pasture-based, meaning the goats spend most of their time outside grazing on acres of grass and shrubs. Like dogs, Jarrell says goats pant when they get too hot and take cover in the shade under trees. And while the farm does have a couple of small barns, he says they're making plans to build a bigger indoor facility, in part because it's getting harder to keep the goats cool enough.
In the summer, when it's going to be hotter and more humid, we need the best ventilation possible, and we need protection.
The price tag on that new barn is nearly $700,000. The Illinois Department of Agriculture doesn't currently offer any assistance or information for farmers dealing with the effects of heat stress on their animals. Jarrell says they'll have to find some way to pay for the new barn, and there are few options, except to pass the costs on to consumers.
Obviously, what we need to do is make sure we can sell the product, and we can look at what customers are willing to pay. Are they willing to pay any more for a product that addresses all these other societal and environmental problems that we're talking about?
Jarrell's hoping the answer is yes. So don't be surprised when you start paying a little more for your milk, pork, or goat cheese. It may just be another cost of doing business in a changing climate. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Dana Cronin in Champaign, Illinois.
More than 20 years ago, Kara Swisher decided to leave the Washington Post to cover the internet full-time. That decision has made her one of the most respected and feared journalists on the beat, holding those in the tech world accountable. She's now the host of the New York Times podcast Sway and the Vox podcast Pivot. And tonight, Swisher offers us her brief but spectacular take on power and responsibility within tech.
When I was younger, I was often the person in class that was like, no. Like, you know, the teacher would say, I'm like, no. Like, no is a really powerful word. I love to use it. When I start off in reporting, you do suspect people. Like, what are they trying to spin me? What are they trying to say? What's their messaging? What do I have to, like, get past to get to the real story? But actually, the real question is what they're lying to themselves about. What do they need to have said about themselves so that they can feel good about talking? And everybody has a thing. A lot of powerful people get licked up and down all day. I'm very obvious. I would say I'm obvious of which way I'm going to go. You have to respect the person's point of view. You don't have to agree with them. And you have to say it out loud. What I hate is when interviewers sort of shake their head and then add on layers of narration that's really obnoxious. Like, I hate that. Like, you better not do that here. I have a lot of information before I talk to people. I'm very skilled at understanding when people are lying to me. I went to the School of Foreign Service. I was super interested in the uses of propaganda, and I studied that in school. I wanted to go into the military. I couldn't because I was gay, courtesy of Bill Clinton. We had Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I wanted to tell. I wanted to be asked. I started my career at the Washington Post. I was walking out of an interview for a book I was working on AOL, my first book on AOL. It was a beautiful day in New York, and I walked out, and I thought, I'm leaving the Washington Post. I'm going to write about the internet. Like, this is going to be so big, this internet thing. This was super early in the 1990s. You could see how bad it could go, and you could see how good it could go. I love tech for its ability to transform people's lives in really positive ways. I love tech, and I hate what they've done to it. Obviously, our history is littered with powerful people make decisions for people who are unelected. But in this case, they can see every bit of your life. Now, it happens that Apple's very good on privacy, but what if it wasn't? My favorite interview was with Elon Musk. I met him when he was a nobody, so we have kind of a really interesting relationship. Silicon Valley is a lot of big minds chasing small ideas, and I think he's a big mind chasing big ideas. I've interviewed Mark Zuckerberg several times. I think very few people are capable of handling the responsibility he has, and he's certainly not up to the task. He's like a world leader without any world leader experience. He wants to create an all-enveloping universe around you of reality, and he's really bad at it.
But you like him.
I do.
Why do you like him?
Because he's a nice boy from Chappaqua, New York. But I think he's lives in a bubble, and he doesn't tolerate dissent very well. I honestly think we should shut it down at this point. You can't fix it. I'm optimistic about climate change technology. I'm confident that there are innovative technological solutions to global warming or living in new ways in a new environmental situation. And so I'm optimistic about that. What I'm not optimistic about is that authoritarian streaks in people will take advantage of all this information and be able to control people in ways that are both subtle and obvious at the same time. My name is Kara Swisher, and this is my brief but spectacular take on tech. Get off your phone. Put it down. Okay, bye.
And you can watch all of our brief but spectacular episodes at pbs.org/newshour/brief. On the NewsHour online, healthcare systems already in harm's way of natural disasters face the increasing threats of climate change. Read more about how hospitals are coping with the potential for flooding on our website. That is pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. Please join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you for joining us. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.